From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 432, Desired State Configuration V2 with guest Don Jones, recorded Monday, July 6th, 2015. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest is a returning guest. It's Don Jones. He's the curriculum director for the online training company Pluralsight and has been a Microsoft MVP award recipient for 14 years. He's the author of dozens of books and is the co-founder of PowerShell.org. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks. Great to be here. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, it has been a while.
Yes, it has. I've been busy.
And we bumped into each other at Ignite, if I remember correctly, with 22,000 of our closest friends.
Yes.
That was quite the show.
It was. There was so much new, including kind of a new take on Microsoft as a company. It was a little bit invigorating.
I like Satya on stage. It makes me happy. You know,
he's got his own style. You haven't been able to say that for a long time, have you?
No, it's been tough. Well, I mean, believe me, Steve Ballmer, I appreciate. There's no two ways about it. He did a lot for the company, but he didn't have the keynote presence to the world. I know the company itself loved him. Like every time you see a great video of Steve Ballmer on stage, he's actually talking to the company, right?
Yeah.
But Satya on stage, he's just got that nice mix of being a technologist, very much a vision guy that the Ballmer never pretended to have. And I appreciate that too. But, you know, I think we're all happier with feeling like a tech guy is in charge.
Well, and I think that the company's been a lot more generous and having more of the tech guys be in charge visibly. You know, guys like Mark Rusinovich,
yep.
No question. Jeffrey Snover, who I got to do a session with there, and the fact that they're able to share this kind of information up front, you know, before they've even released the product is actually kind of a really new thing for them. They used to do that ages and ages ago, but then they quit for a long time. And so it's kind of exciting to be able to talk about products and the technologies and where they're going and what we know is going to happen. We can start thinking about it and start planning for it and looking forward to it. And that's just all kind of cool.
And I think that's as IT people, that's what we need. Like, if you don't let me know about this product until you ship it, you're just delaying me ever deploying it. I don't just grab bits and turn them on, right? It takes time.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially with some of this, you look at desired state configuration. It's such an enormous, complicated piece of moving parts that can do so much, but it's not only how to use it, it's rethinking how we do so many other things that touches. And then they're evolving that so much from the first release into this second release that it's everybody just kind of sit down and think about it. And I love that we have some of those details now.
But they're calling it V5.
Well, it's in PowerShell V5. It's in WMF, Windows Management Framework V5.
Okay.
But it's like the second generation of DSC.
Yeah, and that's always a challenge. I mean, it's nice for us to keep the version numbers in sync too, but it is only the second go at DSC. It is pretty new.
Yeah.
And the first version did a lot, but I felt like you ended up writing a lot of PowerShell around it.
Yes and no. I think the first version gave us a lot of the core paradigm, to overuse a word. And I think the idea is you do still wind up writing a lot of PowerShell, but moving forward, it's going to be a lot more structured, and it'll be a lot easier to share. So if other people are writing PowerShell that's useful, you'll be able to consume that more easily. And I think what they've really done is spent some time overcoming what I felt were a lot of architectural weaknesses.
Oh, interesting.
And you know, any version one product, you're going to have kind of some workarounds and some things that maybe don't work the best, but I think they really paid attention to a lot of those things and they're making it a lot more, it really fit the way we run our companies, which is kind of strange because usually you have to fit your company to the way the product happens to
Absolutely,
work.
Absolutely, yeah.
But they seem to have really paid attention to the way people do these things, which is kind of nice.
And they've been putting out versions of Framework 5 now, I mean, almost every month since the fall of last year.
Yeah. The big public releases have come about once a quarter, maybe a little less frequently, but the MVPs on non-disclosure have been getting it a lot more frequently. Often not even new features. It's just, hey, tell us if we fix such and such a bug that you guys found, that
right.
type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, just, and even just looking at the public view, right? There was no, there was November, there was February, there's an April release. Yep. I mean, it's, if as a regular IT guy, I got to think that's almost overwhelming all by itself.
It can be. I think one of the things that companies have to do is really think about how they're going to keep ahead with these release cadences stepping up.
Right.
It's not enough to just say, okay, every 3 years, we're going to sit down and look at what Microsoft's been up to. You almost have to take some of your team and set aside a little time. They don't need to be experts. I don't even know that you necessarily need to have a lab stood up for all of this stuff, but you need to set aside some time so they can at least understand what the heck is going on, so that when the time comes and you decide if you're going to do this or not, they're not starting from ground zero. They've at least got a clue about what it's supposed to do, what some of the basic capabilities, what some of the limitations. It's just going to have to kind of be a part of the investment landscape. For me, it's not unlike an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an accountant, you sort of have a legal requirement to do a certain amount of education every year.
Sure.
And that's basically so that you can just keep up with the constant rate of change. And I think maybe we should have kind of an internal law of IT that says a certain amount of time is going to have to be set aside just to keep up.
And there is this philosophical part of, if you're thinking DSC, you're thinking about a very different way to deploy and maintain servers. Like that to me, I think is the big leap here. So, okay, if we do this, this is going to change whatever servers we apply it to forever. We're going to think about these differently.
Yeah, it's a drastic change. I mean, it's a process change. What's funny is I'll run into companies that are a little bit resistant to it. And a lot of times it's, well, we already, have these processes and we use ITIL or whatever else. I'm like, no, ITIL would love this. This fits so much better with ITIL than anything you've done before. You really need to think about what you're saying here, because this is the right thing to do.
Yeah. ITIL is all about you really acting as a service organization. And in my mind, DSC just makes us that much more responsive.
Oh, it does. It does. And if you think about the tough thing that Jason Helmick and I did a bunch of MVA stuff for Microsoft, and we did this little public service announcement up front to promote it, and very, very tongue in cheek. Not everybody got the joke, but what we said was, you know what? Don't learn PowerShell. It's too late. Instead, learn DSC.
Oh, wow.
A lot of people were like, how can you say don't learn PowerShell? I'm like, well, yeah, but you have to learn PowerShell to be effective with DSC.
Yeah, it's a joke. Yeah, that's what
you
that
still
is.
Got to.
It's like you don't get to do one without the other.
I actually think it's the best way to learn PowerShell, because if you start with DSC, instead of having to think about how do I do these things and what commands do I have to look up and everything else, your approach to PowerShell can be, what do I want the server to do? I don't have to worry about how. I just have to worry about the what. And so I can start being really effective right away at that what level.
I like that idea of, because one of the problems I find most people getting into PowerShell is you got the classic blank screen effect. All right, dude, what do you want to do?
Yeah, what do I do?
And DSC puts you in a box of, so what did you want this server to do, which is something we generally have on hand, and then it gives you a smaller subsection of the commands to deal with.
And then you can dive as deep as you want to go. You can start coding up custom resources. I mean, you can get very, very deep with PowerShell still in DSC. And as you do that, of course, you're going to learn to use PowerShell in a lot of other places as well. I think it's just a great initial surface, because you're right. It avoids that, okay, here's the blue window, now what?
Yeah.
You kind of get a pre-done starting point. We don't have awesome tools for DSC yet. I suspect those will be coming. But I think right now it's still a very approachable technology.
Yeah, I tend to agree. But I also am very familiar with the fact that people who just sort of pile into PowerShell end up with an array of scripts and not a lot of management around them. And they're code. Like, the dev hat I put on looks at that and go, dude, where's your source management? Where's the documentation? How would anybody else pick these up? It seems like a lot of people's PowerShell scripts are very personal. They're for them to use. They would never let anybody else use them.
They're very personal. They're often not very structured. They're not very reusable.
Mm-hmm.
They really, a lot of times, unfortunately, because I think the sin of PowerShell is that it's like a puppy dog. It wants to be everybody's friend.
Right.
And it doesn't force you into a little bit more of a structure. Like if you have a cat, you've got to have a litter pan someplace. There's just rules you have to follow. And PowerShell is a puppy. It just wants to be happy and lick everyone in the face. And so it lets you get away with stuff that 5 years later, hopefully, you'll look back and go, yeah,
what did I do?
But a lot of folks don't even realize, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so they go down this path and they don't even realize, my gosh, I'm making my job so much harder on myself. That's one of the reasons I wrote the tool making book, was to say, look, if you want to do this, it's fine, but understand the shell will actually do a lot of it for you if you just kind of follow its little path here and maybe rethink the way you're going about it. But yeah, I see a lot of PowerShell scripts that look like VB scripts, and they do make me a little sad, because you work too hard. It becomes this monolithic thing. It's harder to support. I know people are going to regret that someday. I hope they do, because then they'll improve.
Right. Well, and I think that may be the piece that's missing, is this, okay, you're going to get into PowerShell and you're going to do it seriously. Like, your organization's going to begin to depend on PowerShell. What does that full infrastructure, that responsible infrastructure, look like?
Yeah.
How much of this comes from the management framework then?
Not much.
No, that's not what the framework's about.
No, the framework is just a collection of software technologies. You know, it's WMF is kind of a giant set of prerequisites, really.
Yeah.
Microsoft, for better or for worse, has not been able to put out a lot of guidance, just because they don't have enough human beings to pump out code and guidance at the same time.
Yeah.
So they rely a little bit on the community to do it. That's not that different than the real dev world, though. You know, Microsoft has never been one to push out a lot of practices in C# or structure. That kind of comes from the practitioners in the field.
And in some ways, it's more legitimate, too. I mean, for better or worse, the guys at Microsoft do not run large-scale systems for the most part. They're tool builders, not necessarily tool users.
Yeah.
You know, better to take it from these bigger enterprises that are actually taking these tools and putting them in the field, and without the ability to, you know, go down the hall and say, hey, can you rewrite this for me?
Yeah, and I actually use a different set of terminology.
Yeah.
I think we, at the practitioners in the field, I think we're actually the tool makers.
Hmm.
Microsoft produces raw materials.
Okay.
And it's like having a pile of wood. What good is that for? Well, nothing in and of itself, but you can burn it. You can make a house out of it. You can make a tree house. You can make all kinds of stuff. So they're providing us with raw materials and maybe some hand tools, but it's our job to really put those together into things.
I appreciate that. That's a great sentiment, really, that in the end, we make the cabinets. They only make the wood.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's an industry battle on it. So, second version of DSC, how big a leap are we making?
Pretty big. Completely backward compatible.
Okay.
So everything you've done before, if you've done anything, should still work just fine. But there's really two areas where they've made a ton of investment. The first one's a little easier to understand, and it's, if you're building your own resources, you now have the option, and you absolutely should take it, of building those as classes. So before, we really just, you had a script module and you put three functions and you had to make sure they were named the same thing. And if you mistyped them, they wouldn't work. And there was just a lot of, you need to make sure you do it the right way because we're not going to enforce anything.
Right.
The only difference with classes is really you change a couple of keywords and now PowerShell can enforce the structure. Hmm. Hey, I'm not even going to try and run this. I'm going to tell you right now, you named this the wrong thing or you did this wrong. So it's just a way for them to give us a little bit more design time structure. And so I think that's a big deal. But what I think probably less attention has been put on, and what actually involves a lot more complexity, is the planning and architecture in DSC5 is hugely expanded. Before every single node in your environment could be configured to pull their config from a pull server.
Right.
Well, now they can be configured to pull from multiple pull servers and they can get a bit of their config. So it's kind of like with a group policy. Before, you could only have one GPO per node.
Right.
Now they can go grab multiples and merge them together. And so you can have one pull server and the node can be told, hey, you're going to be a SQL server. And so the only place you're allowed to get SQL Server information is from this pull server. And those people are authoritative and they're the only ones you listen to.
Hmm.
And if anyone else tries to ship you SQL Server stuff, you ignore it. And so you can set up this kind of authoritative thing that really reflects how we run our organizations.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was, you said this earlier, right?
Yeah.
We now have a tool that allows the fact that I have a group of DBAs who are database specialists, who have a set of policies, and really don't want to be responsible in other areas. Like, that's their area of expertise. They can own a pull server for all of that.
Yep. And they can't necessarily touch your core security config or your core server, which can come from different places. And so that was a big deal. And then the other thing, which is relatively new in the latest release, the April release, is the configuration ID that a node uses to identify itself. So when it goes to the pull server and say, hey, give me my config, here's my ID, those are now text strings, not globally unique identifiers.
Right.
Meaning your configuration can just be called Enterprise Standard SQL Server, and everybody can look at that file on disk and understand what it means. And so the node can just go grab that, and any node that might need that same set of config can grab that. And then they identify themselves uniquely for reporting purposes. So when they're checking in with a reporting server, I am node, blah, 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 so that everybody has a unique status in the reporting server, even if they're all pulling the same config. And that was always a problem before, is you kind of had to decide that everyone was the same or that you were okay lumping them, but it took place for reporting as well. So now that's all separated out. So the structure has become a ton more flexible. So between these so-called partial configs, which is where you're pulling a bit from every pull server, you still have the ability to produce composite configurations. You can create your own resources. You have reporting. There's really, really so much more you can do. Another major thing, even if you've got a server that you don't want pulling, you want to push its config,
right?
You can still tell it, hey, I'm always going to push your config to you, but if I tell you to configure something and you don't have the necessary resources, go up to this pull server all on your own and see if that pull server has them. And if it does, download them and install them. So you can have one central place on your network where you keep all of your DSC code, your resources. And then no matter how a machine obtains its configuration, push or pull, it can still go to that software distribution point and grab that stuff. And the beauty of it, none of this has any reliance on domain boundaries at all. All of this happens whether you're in a domain or not.
Interesting. That sort of speaks to this idea of DSC being its own specialty, that you might have a group of people, that's what they do.
It is. And it's separated from AD because, well, at the end of the day, Microsoft built this in part to help make running Azure easier. And not every machine in Azure is in the same domain. So
right.
I said, you know what? Let's just build something that talks plain old HTTP to a web server and doesn't need any of the Active Directory stuff because we can't assume that's always going to be a prerequisite.
Absolutely. And speaking of configuration, Run As Radio is brought to you by ScriptRock, the makers of Guardrail and the fighters of configuration drift. Configuration drift happens in every environment from 5 nodes to 5,000. Guardrail will find and scan the configs of every node in your environment, no matter the platform, and alert you to changes happening across machines. Give it a try for 3 months free with the coupon code RUNASRADIO, all one word, at ScriptRock.com/RUNASRADIO. I still sort of battling between this idea of DSC as a sort of global skill for anybody administrating servers versus DSC specialists.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be both. I think what you'll probably wind up with is a very small number of people in an organization who are producing the resources that actually do the work, because that is definitely a more structured programming developer style thing, to the point where my understanding is, my belief is that Visual Studio is going to start providing some PowerShell level support for that use case. Not that everybody using PowerShell needs to run out and spend $2,000 on a copy of Visual Studio, but
right.
for the folks who are producing this enterprise level functional code that's got to be very robust and error handly and loggy and everything else, they're going to produce those. So you'll have a small number of people in your organization at the top who are getting paid the most who produce those resources. The next tier down will produce the configurations that consume those resources. So, you know, given such and such an enterprise application, the small tier will write the resources that can configure it. And then the next tier down will consume that and they'll specify what the configuration is. They won't necessarily have visibility into how it happens. It'll just be a magical black box.
That almost sounds like when you get into larger organizations, you have enterprise architects and developers of enterprise frameworks that then have developers that are consuming those resources that actually make their software compliant with the standards that an enterprise wants.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of us have really had that structure already. You've got your help desk. Your help desk is good at pushing buttons. If you're a smart organization, the next tier up is good at making buttons for the help desk to push.
Right.
When I was at Bell Atlantic, I never fixed a problem that came over from the help desk. I wrote a script so that the help desk could fix the problem for themselves, and then I would never hear about it again. And that's the right approach. And DSC, I think, really falls in line with that approach, even though a lot of organizations haven't got to that level of maturity. I think at least within the DSC scope, it'll be a little bit easier to do that. It'll feel a little bit more natural. You'll have developers and then people who use that code.
Yeah, and it does seem like this is a progression of the tool itself, right? When we DSC at the beginning is sort of a hacky tool for experiments and so forth, and we're starting to see the formalization of how an organization would really make this a core part of their practices.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons it, honestly, for me, it still comes across as a little hacky. And I think the reason for that is, although the functionality is maturing, which we would expect, Microsoft has not yet produced tooling.
Right.
And I think this gets back to the, they've got just enough time on the cadence they're working at to produce raw materials. They don't have a lot of time to give us tools to work with those. And so, you know, we're out here with stones and chisels trying to build complicated structures out of this pile of wood we were given, because Microsoft hasn't given us power tools and saws and hammers and things like that. So.
And the use of Visual Studio as a shell for other things. I mean, they did the SQL Server Management.
Yep.
It's totally doable. Plus, it's not that far away. The fact that you could tap into TFS resources, source management resources, testing resources that are already part of the Studio suite makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things that are happening with WMF5 too that support that story. One is that there's a Visual Studio extension set that gives Visual Studio PowerShell capabilities, and that's really where it's coming from. And so that's already an open source project that's been out there. Microsoft is now contributing to that. Mm-hmm. So they've become a part of that. They've adopted that. And so that's where they're going to get this Visual Studio, you know, supporting PowerShell stuff is from this open source project.
That's not an unprecedented practice either.
No.
It was Damian Edwards and SignalR, which originally developed as this open source thing that got pulled into the ASP.NET core.
Yeah. Yeah. And so even a bigger statement of that, you mentioned testing. The PowerShell test framework, Pester, which is open source, is going to be in Windows Server 2016. It will be in the box.
Nice.
And the belief is, my understanding is, this is the first time Microsoft has taken open source code and shipped it as part of their commercial product.
It's part of Server.
Server.
You know, it's one thing over on the dev side with all their open source. Yeah, though that would be a profound statement.
Yep. And so the vision. And I think this is something that people should really look at because, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about how a lot of PowerShell stuff just doesn't seem to, people don't take it seriously. Where's your source control? Where's all this other stuff? Well, here's the vision.
The same way they didn't really take scripting in general seriously. Scripting's always been that sort of personal. The smart IT guy has this toolkit of scripts he's written and that's what he does with them.
And so the evolution of that is you check your code into a repository, some source control repository. Let's say you have a private Git repo or perhaps use TFS. Upon checking it in, you trigger a series of automated tests. Now, in the PowerShell world, those would likely be written in Pester. And so your tests test all of the code. And if the code passes, the code gets deployed to a public repository, like a chocolatey repository, where people in your environment can then download, and I say public, I mean available to your organization,
right,
not the actual world. And so people can download that and update themselves. If the code fails its tests, then you get a notification back and you can go modify it and check it in and try again. So you've got your source control, which has got your dev branch, and you've got the testing in the middle, and you have to clear the test barrier before things wind up in the production repo. And that is really kind of how Microsoft is doing their internal development on a lot of products now. And that whole process, continuous integration, is a service that we are actually going to be standing up at PowerShell.org. So if your code is in a public repo, like a public GitHub, you can sign up for our service. It'll be free. We'll have continuous integration with TeamCity we're building up and everything else. So we'll grab your code, we'll run your tests, and if it works, we'll dump it into a chocolatey repository where PowerShell Package Manager can then go retrieve that for anybody in the public that wants to use it. And so I think that starts to add a lot of structure, but I think it adds structure by giving you value. So it's no longer just me standing on a chair at a conference going, my God, why aren't you using source control? You're all going to go to hell, which I've done. Now you're going to want to use the source control because in exchange for doing so, I'm going to give you an automated testing and deployment platform. So your tests will be done. Once you write your tests will run for you. You'll get the feedback. If everything worked, it goes right into production. So I'm making your life simpler and more reliable and more stable in exchange for you doing the right thing. And so it's a little bit more of a virtuous cycle than just a task that you have to do that you didn't really want to.
Yeah. Well, and actually accumulating knowledge then to the organization, getting, letting the organization get better and better. You know, the next step past this is, at what point is another IT person going to be confident using your script? And what does that even look like? Like, is there a dashboard in our future here?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, you know, you spend so much time when you're learning PowerShell, learning to do some of the basics, learning to use the help system, learning to use things in the pipeline, learning to discover, learning to explore on your own. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that if you write your tools and you follow those patterns and practices that are already native to the shell, then the investment other people have put into learning how to use PowerShell will pay off, because they'll be able to learn to use your scripts as well.
Right.
And I think PowerShell gives us the structure. It just doesn't force us into it. So if you want to do garbage code, you can do garbage code.
That's got to be the Microsoft mantra. You know, it's your foot.
Yeah.
We'll still let you shoot it off.
Yeah. Here's the gun. Here's your foot. You figure it out. But I think for the people that are making the investment and really kind of stepping up their game a little bit, they do find that there's a big payoff, because other people can use their scripts right. much more easily. So one of the things we do at PowerShell.org at our annual summit event, we do a verified effective exam. So it's a live proctored exam. And one of the scenarios, broadly speaking, is you get a transcript. So it's a shell transcript. So you can see someone running this tool, and you can see the error messages and the output it produces and the help messages and the entire experience. And you're asked to reproduce that tool. And it kind of tests your ability to, do you know how to produce something that acts like a PowerShell tool? You know, given what it looks like, can you reproduce that? And for the people who pass that, and it's not a super high pass rate, I'll tell you, the people who pass that are really, really good PowerShell tool makers.
Yeah, I like that concept of proven effective.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's a new thing that we're doing. We just did it at the U.S. Summit in Charlotte last April. We'll do it again in the upcoming summit in Stockholm in September. And that'll probably become a regular feature of PowerShell summits.
Just to actually, what does it mean to be, give them the blank screen and say go, and they have somewhere to go.
Right.
Although, I mean, my reflex now with anything related to PowerShell, because admittedly, I don't use it enough, is get on the search, because odds are what you need to do, somebody's already written.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, if the command was written right, that example that you're looking for is already in the help.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to go on a search engine to find that. You should just be able to jump in there and figure it out. But yeah, that's what a lot of people are doing. And that's what they did for VBScript too. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing I caution people is, you know, look, we are DevOps people. We are pragmatic. We don't have time necessarily just to sit down and learn things in abstract. We learn best when we've got a task to complete.
Yep.
But once you've done it, take it home that night and read the code. And if you don't know why all of that copy paste is in there, at least get on some forums like serverfault.com or the forums at powershell.org and ask, hey, I did this. It works perfectly. It does what I need. What do these three lines mean? Why are those there?
That's fair. Well, there is a whole concept here, and it's true in programming too, of thou shalt not run code you don't understand.
Yeah.
You don't have to have written every line of it. You can go borrow it from elsewhere. But at least know what it does.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that gives you the most value too, because you're going to learn the code you didn't understand is the ones you'll learn from that'll actually, you know, give you some new insight in the way things can work.
Right. And it's the mistake making. And I think I always get frustrated that people don't have a little test environment spun up that they can play with PowerShell code to see what it does and change things and comment things and break things. We get into to be adults and we get in these production environments, and breaking things in production is obviously so traumatic that we get this massive aversion to error. And at the end of the day, our monkey brains learn from error. It's the stuff we break that we learn from.
And but so it's you so have easy to now, yourself. Right? It's just a VM. Set up a it VM. Get you know, go to work.
I use cloudshare.com. And if you've ever played with that, they charge me $500 a year. I can have 6 VMs running. And the neat thing is they've got all these templates, so they can spin up an entire environment for me. I push a button. I come back 10 minutes later. I didn't have to sit through the installs or anything else.
Right.
So the boring, dull stuff is over, and I can just start playing around with it. Now I've started using DSC to stand up my own lab environments. So I push a button. It deploys a DSC script to my Hyper-V host, which starts spinning up virtual machines. It injects DSC into them. They configure themselves. So, you know, at night before I go to bed, I'll hit the button. I wake up the next morning. I've got my whole lab environment, and right. It runs on one tiny little shoebox computer, and I've got everything I need.
You actually do all the testing. Great way to get going with DSC is start building your lab with it so that it's a one button click to reestablish your lab.
Yeah.
But I appreciate stuff like cloud sharing. You can do this with Azure as well to, if you, you know, use your MVP account that however many dollars you get a month to fire up a test lab. That's what that was for, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I do that quite a bit. A lot of MVPs do. I think a lot of MCTs don't realize that, you know, part of the multiple hundreds of bucks they're paying gets them $150 or so in Azure credit every month. Every MSDN account comes with, depending on the level you're at, some amount of Azure time.
Yeah.
So you've got it there. And if nothing else, if you just got a poor internet connection, you can spend under $500 and have a nice little lab computer.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need to process financial transactions. It just needs to run.
Yeah. It doesn't even have to be particularly fast. You just need to know that when I run this script, it does what I expect, not what I didn't expect.
Yeah, and it's a great way to play around. I have learned more from DSC. In fact, I'm getting ready to do a series of a course for Microsoft's Courseware Marketplace, so instructor-led training courseware. And I have gotten more value out of my lab environment to create the labs for that course, having that there and just being able to play around with it and knowing that I'm not actually going to break anything that can't be repaired very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep having a contained environment so that you really can just try stuff. The challenge for me, and I have seen this happen, is you get comfortable in your lab experimenting, and then you switch over to the production environment and forget.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why DSC excites me so much, though, because here's the story. You get it working in your lab environment. You check it into source control. From that source control, you deploy it to a QA environment, perhaps. Large organizations tend to do three tiers. Mm-hmm. If it fails in QA, you don't fix it there. You go back to your lab environment, fix it there. Once QA does the same thing as your lab environment, you're pretty sure that you got it right. And then you can take that exact same component, put it on a pull server in the production environment, and it should behave exactly the same way it did in the other two. And so it gives you this really repeatable set of circumstances that takes a lot of the human error out. You can sort of beat your human error out of the code. And then once you've done that, you know it's going to be pretty reliable from there.
It's fair. So, Don, where can folks see you next? I mean, obviously, PowerShell.org, you're all over it.
Yep. Next, I will be in Redmond at campus, Microsoft Campus for TechMentor, TechMentorEvents.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's early August. And then in September, I think like the 14th or so, there's a Friday in September, I will be in Helsinki, Finland at an MVP All-Stars event being put together by a fellow PowerShell MVP. And then the following Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'll be in Stockholm for PowerShell Summit, powershellsummit.org.
Awesome.
And then I think the last one for the year is going to be the week before Thanksgiving. I'll be in Orlando at a TechMentor events down there. And then that'll be it for the year.
Yeah, you'll be getting around.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming back to the show. It's been entirely too long, and I appreciate your insights.
Absolutely. It's good to talk to you again.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.